Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The votes are in, and its official Citigroup is too big to fail. The only vote that mattered was cast late last night when Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson threw another $20 billion at the problem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It's the 24th of November, as the fallout from the financial crisis just won't go away. Citigroup is the latest brand name bank brought low by its exposure to subprime mortgages. The deal to save it that was announced last night is complicated, but there are two key points that'll put it in perspective for you. One, as I said, the bank gets another $20 billion worth of fresh capital. That's on top of the $25 billion it got from the Treasury Department a month and a half or so ago. And in return, and point number two, taxpayers are on the hook for most of the losses generated by some of Citi's toxic assets, those mortgage-backed securities we've all come to know and love. John Carney is the editor of the business website ClusterStock.com. John, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Let me walk you through the sequence of events here. First, we had the TARP. They were going to buy up toxic assets, and then we didn't. It was going to be capital injections. Now we're back to the TARP again, right?
They've really sort of tried to be agile all along the way. And it seems like what Henry Paulson's doing is trying to be the same kind of agile regulator that he was when he was an investment banker.
Is that agility doing what needs to be done to help Citigroup in this case? Is this a good plan?
I think in Citigroup's case, they needed to do something to reassure the markets that it wasn't going to consistently be hit by owning all these assets that everybody feared was worthless. But it's having a negative effect on the markets, too, in that nobody can predict what the government is going to do week to week.
This was another last-minute rescue effort by the Treasury Department. Here we are again, waiting on Sunday night to figure out what everybody's going to do.
I think, actually, it puts a lot of fear into the markets. Everybody sits there on Friday and says, is my position safe since I can't tell what the government's going to do over the weekend?
Let me ask you about the specifics of this plan. As part of it, we learned that Citigroup has at least $306 billion of these toxic assets. Is it fair to assume that that's part of the reason that Paulson backed away from the toxic asset purchase plan in the first place? Because if Citigroup's got $306 billion, about half the plan, is it fair to assume that everybody else has billions and billions more?
Absolutely. I think that initially they underestimated the total size of the bad assets that were on the bank's balance sheet. I think they figured out very quickly that what they thought was a large number, $700 billion, turned out not to be anywhere near large enough.
Clearly, what Secretary Paulson is trying to do with this plan and everything else he's done so far is to restore faith in the financial system and in the banks. Is he doing that?
I don't think that it's succeeding because there's a fatal flaw, which is all along what got Citigroup in trouble and what got everybody else in trouble was the idea that we were having a temporary market downturn, that the assets were being priced irrationally low, that the market was just illiquid for a short time. But that's been going on now for over a year. What's really happened is that the underlying assets, the mortgages and the home prices, have become worth a lot less than everybody thought they were when they got into these investments. And until we really settle down to realize that banks have to write everything down to an actual market level, people aren't going to be confident that the banks are healthy again.
Last March, we had Bear Stearns. It got rescued. Then in September, we had Lehman. It didn't get rescued. Is this now the deciding vote? Two out of three votes say, yeah, let's rescue?
They tried not to rescue Lehman in an attempt to say these have too bad of an effect on the market, that it had the danger of allowing people to think that they could engage in as risky investments as they wanted to and the government would come bail them out. With Bear Stearns, they wanted to calculate the idea of putting risk back into the market and making people be more cautious, both about their equity investments, buying stock in investment banks, and the investment banks themselves behaving better. But the fallout from Lehman is widely considered to have been so financially devastating that they've now decided that they're not going to let any sizable, well-connected firm go under.
John Carney, he's the editor at ClusterStock.com. John, thanks a lot for your time. Those leaks Friday afternoon about the economic team that's going to take over this financial crisis in a couple of months prove themselves true today. The president-elect named New York Fed Chief Timothy Geithner to be Treasury Secretary and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers to run the National Economic Council. He also picked Berkeley economist Christina Romer to head the Council of Economic Advisors. Other than that, though, Mr. Obama was kind of short on economic specifics, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
The president-elect says there's a consensus that a stimulus package is necessary, but he wouldn't say how big, other than it will be costly.
We have to make sure that the stimulus is significant enough that it really gives a jolt to the economy, that it is putting people back to work, that it is making investments, that it is restoring some confidence in the business community, that in fact their products and services are going to have customers.
Some Democrats say the economy is in such dire condition the stimulus needs to be in the range of $500 to $700 billion. Obama has talked about tax credits for job creation, help for families facing foreclosure, as well as infrastructure spending on roads, bridges, and green energy projects. Like the last stimulus, the government will have to borrow the money by selling treasury bonds. Cato Institute economist Jerry O'Driscoll wonders whether there will be enough investors willing to buy those bonds.
At some point, you will get to a situation where you're going to cause problems, especially at the long end of the treasury bond market, and risk a dollar crash. And I don't know what that point is. The market will tell us, and unfortunately, it may not give us much advance notice.
But for now, stock markets welcome the economic moves announced today. O'Driscoll says that might be because they see an end to a leadership vacuum.
I think the markets now understand the Obama economic team is in place and that anything else that is done in this administration will have his blessing and will in effect be Obama policy.
Obama said he'll have more announcements tomorrow, including thoughts on how to reform the budget process and change the way Washington does business. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Bloomberg News got very specific with the total cost of the bailout today. Add up all the various lending programs and the total amount that could be borrowed. Bundle that with the actual cash spent so far, and it comes to $7.4 trillion, about half the size of the whole economy, plus or minus. On Wall Street, the Geithner bounce that ended the day Friday kept right on going. The biggest two-day rally in 20 years, in case you keep track. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so Citigroup is saved. The president-elect is alluding to a supersized stimulus package. Unnoticed in today's headlines, though, is this little tidbit. The housing market still stinks. Existing home sales fell another 3% last month. The average house today is worth just about what it was early in 2004. Commentator Dean Baker says attention must be paid.
When our political leaders come up with proposals for fixing the economy, they better remember how we got into this mess. The core problem is the loss of housing wealth, not access to credit. Homeowners have lost more than $5 trillion in real housing wealth in the last 2 years and are likely to lose another $3 trillion. That's almost $110,000 in equity for every homeowner in the country. That loss of wealth led directly to the plunge in consumption, which is pushing us into a deep recession. The current fixation on consumer credit misses the point. Yes, people are having trouble getting loans for cars and other big-ticket items. They're also finding it more difficult to get credit cards or student loans. But the primary problem is not the liquidity of the financial system. It's that the loss of housing equity has made tens of millions of families less creditworthy. People with equity in their homes don't typically default on debts. If they face economic hardship, they will borrow against their equity in order to pay off a car loan or credit card balance. People without home equity generally don't have any other resources to fall back on, and therefore are serious default risks. All the homeowners who've seen their equity vanish due to falling house prices are now in this less creditworthy category. So it's no surprise that banks and other financial companies are now less anxious to make consumer loans. Of course, even if banks did make the loans available, many families still wouldn't buy. People who lost their life savings in the housing crash are more interested in rebuilding their wealth than buying a new car. Consumer spending alone will not bring us out of recession. In fact, our problem was that we had too much consumer spending, driven by ephemeral housing bubble wealth. Recovery will have to be driven by other sources, like government spending and an improved trade balance. Until then, the obsession over consumer credit is only a distraction from the economy's real problems.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. You can direct your thoughts our way online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. We've been asking a question the past couple of weeks. What are you doing, you and everybody else who's been affected by what's happening in the economy? Today we hear from somebody whose job it is to track just that.
My name is Ryan Brecht. I work as an economist for Action Economics, forecasting economic data for the U.S. There's a combination of more work professionally. It's considerably more fast-paced than it has been in the past. I spend my entire day watching these things. And so when I go home, I find it's useful not to think about it. But ultimately, you do think about it. Given my job, I of course see the year-over-year changes in food prices. And so I know that the prices are higher. On a week-to-week basis, you notice it a little bit. But when you come to the end of the month and you add up how much you spent on food, you realize actually it's quite a bit higher. Now we watch that pretty closely because it does add up. There has been a tendency in some interviews I've seen with economists for them to come off as purely concerned about gyrations of supply and demand curves. You do tend to think in terms of numbers initially, but you always do think about, especially when you see the employment report, you know, these huge job losses. Those are all people that have lost their jobs. It's kind of hard not to think about, you know, all these households that are going to be affected because someone lost a job.
Ryan Brecht is a forecaster with Action Economics in San Francisco. You can hear more of Fallout, that's our coverage of the financial crisis, on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, a big retail chain tries to cut its losses.
We're down less than just about all of our competitors, but it doesn't feel good to be down. There's no question about it. And then, you know, you have a sense that the consumer's feeling that same way.
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time Macy's CEO. But first, let's do the numbers. Little bit Geithner, a little bit Citigroup, truth be told. The Dow Industrials jumped up 396 points, just shy of 5%, ended at 84.43. The NASDAQ soared 87 points, 6.3%, finished at 1472. The S&P 500 bounced up 51 points, almost 6.5%, closed at 851. Citigroup vaulted more than 57%. The bailouts spiffed up the fortunes of other banks, too. Bank of America pulled up more than 27%. J.P. Morgan Chase gained more than 21%. Today, talk of a new stimulus package helped others pick up steam as well. Apple snapped up more than 12%. Today, Microsoft added 5%. Alcoa buffed up 8.4%. Xerox toned up almost 18%. Today, the company forecast 2009 profits would be in line with analysts' expectations. Anybody notice that oil jumped 10% today, up another $5 to around $55 a barrel? The 10-year T-note lost more ground today. The yield rose to 3.33%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the preliminary third quarter gross domestic product report. Keeping Santa and other shoppers informed, the Public Interest Research Group releases its 23rd annual Toy Safety Report. And it's the UN's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President-elect Obama was deliberately vague today when he was asked how big a stimulus package he's working on. Suffice it to say, it'll be big. The European Commission set to announce its strategy the day after tomorrow. Also big, probably. But long before the immediate financial crisis, parts of Europe were already hurting. Poor immigrant suburbs near Paris, especially. 3 years ago, high unemployment sparked huge riots there. The jobless rate in some of those suburbs is still twice the French national average, near 15%. President Nicolas Sarkozy wants to spend $1.5 billion to change that, which has dozens of the biggest companies in France, including the public transit operator RATB, coming to town to hire. Anita Elash reports.
There's only one place to be this morning in the poor Paris suburb of Sarcelles, here at this bus-turned-job recruitment center. Dozens of immigrants from Africa and the Middle East are filling out applications for that rare opportunity, a permanent full-time job. This man is a 45-year-old Algerian immigrant who has lived in France for 30 years. He wants to work in maintenance. He says he's worked part-time or in short-term contracts all his life, but he has a family now, and so he can't live that way anymore. He says he needs a job where he can see the future. The RATP plans to hire 2,500 full-time bus drivers, electricians, and maintenance workers every year for the next 4 years. Most of them will come from places like Sarcelles. And the RATP isn't the only one with jobs to offer. 50 of France's largest companies plan to hire up to 100,000 workers from the suburbs in the next 3 years. Companies like supermarket chain Carrefour and the carmaker Renault. Serge Morelli is a human resources executive with the giant insurance company AXA France. He says, like many companies, AXA is looking to the suburbs because its employees are getting old. One-fifth of them will retire in the next 3 years.
Every company in France is facing the same problem, an aging population that in the next few years will be retiring in large numbers. So that means there's a huge demand for new employees.
Morelli says demand for young, educated workers in places like Sarcelles is now so high that many job candidates don't show up for interviews. They've already been hired by someone else. But there's still concern that all these new hiring programs won't do enough to help workers at the bottom of the job ladder.
Comment s'appelle cette boîte de nuit?
Le 56.
Counselors at this local employment office in Sevran, another poor suburb that was hit by riots, see hundreds of unskilled and uneducated job hunters every day. Pierre Mouget is the director.
Alors, les effets, ce sont des jeunes.
Mouget says it's easier for many of the young people who come to the employment office to get job interviews now, but he says the number who actually get jobs has barely gone up. Mouget says many of these would-be workers can't afford a driver's license, much less a car, to get to work. And they'll need a lot more training before they have the skills required for many of the jobs that are up for grabs. But there's time. The RATP's recruitment bus and many of France's biggest companies will be back next year. In the suburbs outside Paris, I'm Anita Elash for Marketplace.
According to the Federal Reserve, American consumers collectively owe almost $1 trillion. That's not even counting home loans. It's what's called revolving credit. Sum total for all of our credit cards, auto loans, all that stuff. Unfortunately, the number itself isn't surprising. We've been a nation of borrowers for a while now. What might be surprising is the news that we're changing those habits. Retailers are starting to see a preference for cash on the barrelhead, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
The shift away from credit cards may not be as big as it could be, says Scott Hoyt of MoodysEconomy.com. He says different groups of people are adjusting to the downturn in different ways.
You have some, you know, higher income consumers who used to use their home equity and are now shifting back to credit cards. You have other consumers who are trying harder to live on their budget and are shying away from their credit cards.
It's not hard to find people in the latter situation on the streets of New York.
Well, over the last year, I've gone out of my way to get completely out of debt. All I owe right now is what I've spent this week.
Yeah, if there's no cash, we're just not going to buy.
Retailers may cry when they hear that, but Stephen Brobeck of the Consumer Federation of America says it's a smart consumer strategy.
When you go to the mall, you can actually cut your expenditures if you pay by cash or check as opposed to paying with a credit card.
Now, to be clear, the shift away from credit cards is not all about consumers making wise decisions. Patricia Edwards of the retail consulting firm Storehouse Partners says part of it is brought on by the credit card companies themselves.
Target's credit card, Citigroup, American Express, all of them have told us that they are cutting back on the amount of credit that they are giving to their consumers, and they are raising interest rates in order to protect themselves as the consumer goes through the downturn.
Unfortunately for retailers, that could mean an even gloomier holiday shopping season. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Other than working on Wall Street, there are probably few industries this holiday season where the mood is more grim than in retail. Consumer spending has come to a screeching halt. Predictions are for meager growth in Christmas sales over last year. Even the National Retail Federation, the industry's main trade group, says 2008 is going to be challenging. So what better time to talk to the CEO of one of the biggest retailers in the country?
The boss will see you now.
This week on Conversations from the Corner Office, Macy's CEO Terry Lundgren. The company's flagship store, Macy's Herald Square in New York City, is all decked out for the holidays. And that's where we talked last week. Here we are in the biggest department store in the world. We're in the middle of a recession. The economy's terrible. There's a credit crisis. And yet this morning when I waited to get in here, there were hundreds of people trying to get in the door. What's going on with that?
Well, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, for you, I suppose, yeah.
That's a good thing. Look, it's a challenging economy. There's no question about it. We fortunately have been able to outpace our competitors all year long, and I suspect we'll be able to do that through the holiday season in spite of the challenging time.
You say you're going to outpace your competitors, but in fact, sales are down. I mean, you're not doing great.
No, we're not doing great. We're not happy about being down. We're down less than just about all of our competitors, but it doesn't feel good to be down. There's no question about it. And you know, you have a sense that the consumer's feeling that same way. You know, they'd like to be here. They'd like to be full of confidence and spending, but that's not in the cards at the moment, so we're going to do the best we can to take as much market share as we possibly can during the rest of this holiday season.
Getting bigger when times are bad, right?
Well, you have to, because, you know, in strong companies like ours, been around for 150 years, what we have to do is think through how do you get through this time and how do you position yourself so when the consumer does come back and come back in full force, you're stronger and that you're in position to do business and do business very successfully. So that's how we're thinking about the time we're in.
Give me your guess, based on your experience in retail, as to when that consumer is going to come back. How long is it going to take?
Well, I could do that, but I'd probably be wrong. Because,
well, go ahead. Come on.
Because, there's been so many guesses out there, and everybody's sort of calibrating those guesses at this point in time. So I don't want to put a number on it because I don't want to be the one who claims it's going to take longer than it is, and I obviously don't want to jump the gun. So I think our plan, Kai, is to make sure that we're just thinking through how do you remain competitive? How do you represent the fashion drive that's made our company successful for so many years?
The big ad campaign for you guys this year is the 150th anniversary. You're making a big splash about it, seeing the newspaper ad saying, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, come back to Macy's, we're 150 years old. Walmart, on the other hand, is basically saying in its ad campaigns, hey, Christmas costs less here. How do you compete with that in a down economy?
Well, you know, Walmart is a terrific retailer, and they focus on a very simple message: low price. I think we offer something quite different than that. We offer a different level of service. Hopefully, we offer certainly a different level of fashion. We offer brand names that would never be in many stores across the country, and so customers choose to come to a store like Macy's for very different reasons.
Let me back you up a couple of years. Okay. 2005, you decided to buy Mays, the department store company, to launch, and you decided to launch Macy's as a national brand. You rebranded a bunch of acquisitions that you made, especially Marshall Field's in Chicago, Filene's out of Boston. We did some stories on that at the time at Marketplace, and I can't tell you how irate people were. They were just so angry with you for rebranding those things. Why did you do it?
Well, first of all, I know there's a lot of emotion attached to those brands, but I wouldn't have done it if they were working. So if the customers who were so emotional were actually in those stores and buying instead of just reacting, that we would never have done it. But it was an absolute need to do it because they were having a hard time competing on a local level. That competition had changed. You know, the world had changed in the last 50 or 100 years since those brands had been in existence. And so while it was emotional, there was really no option. Macy's couldn't even advertise in our own Thanksgiving Day parade. We weren't a national brand. We had stores on the East Coast and the West Coast. And the acquisition of the May Company was to fill in the entire middle of the United States. And that's what we did.
Last question before I let you go. Do you get special seats for the parade?
I do.
Where do you get to sit?
Right in the middle. If you look at the camera shot, you'll see my family right behind it. And that's not something I haven't missed in 14 years, and I'll definitely be there Thanksgiving.
Terry Lundgren, Chairman and CEO of Macy's. Mr. Lundgren, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
We've got more of my interview with Terry Lundgren and conversations from other corner offices on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A couple of final notes today on the theme of it looks like car makers really are serious about cutting costs. First, you remember last week the CEOs of Detroit's Big Three got all that flack after they flew private jets to Washington for their hearings. Now there's talk of organizing a giant carpool to get them back to Washington in a couple of weeks. I know you might have seen it on Saturday Night Live this weekend, too, but it's a real idea. It's being driven in part by a parts supplier in Michigan. And General Motors is cutting Tiger Woods loose. The company said today it's going to end its endorsement deal with the world's best golfer a year early. Should save him a bit more than $1 million. Tiger's people said the decision was entirely mutual. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 396 points, nearly 5%. The NASDAQ bumped up 87 points, 6.3%. The S&P 500 added 51 points, nearly 6.5% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, Pink Slips That Pack a Punch.
The person who you thought you had a great rapport with and they just totally dumped you for no reason, that's what getting laid off feels like.
Ouch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.